This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The legislature convenes in Montpelier later this week, and they'll have to get started right away on some big issues. Once they get the election of the new governor out of the way, they'll be talking about education spending and school consolidation, about how to fund major transportation infrastructure, about whether or not to raise taxes to pay for basic state functions, and about a host of potential other issues like paid sick leave, marijuana legalization, and health care payment reform. The Democrats hold the majority in both the House and the Senate, not to mention other top elected positions. So today on the program, we're going to spend some time with two of the other major parties in the legislature, the Republicans and the Progressives. We'll hear from members of both the House and Senate on what they see as top priorities for the legislature as a whole and for their caucuses in particular. In a little while, we'll hear from progressives David Zuckerman and Chris Pearson. But first, let's talk with a couple of prominent Republicans. Senator Joe Benning from Lindenville is Senate Minority Leader, and he serves on the Judiciary and Rules Committees. Senator Benning, nice to have you on the program again.
Good afternoon, Jane. Thanks for having me.
And Representative Heidi Sherman represents Stowe in the House and serves on the Commerce and Economic Development Committee. Representative Sherman, nice to talk with you again as well.
Thank you, Jane. Thanks for having me.
One of the main tasks of the legislature, and certainly one of the most complicated and fraught questions, is passing a budget. Senator Benning, you're beating the drum for higher taxes this year. Why don't you explain what you'd like to see and why you think raising taxes is necessary?
Well, I heard that headline on your news report, and I was ready to call Senator Benning and give him a piece of my mind because that is actually not what I am asking for. I was involved in an interview on Friday, in fact, several interviews Friday, and one reporter asked me some questions and took one particular sentence, in my eyes, out of context of where I was going with it. So let me be very clear. I am not advocating for new taxes. I am definitely advocating for trying to streamline government, for taking some time in the legislature to examine everything we do as a state and decide whether or not we can't deliver essential services in a more streamlined fashion. I did have a conversation about the size of the hole that we are in fiscally, and I did not see any way we were going to get out of that hole without going through a very rigorous process of streamlining services and possibly having to raise taxes. But I am in no way, shape, or form proposing new taxes, and I probably wouldn't vote for them if they were instituted.
Wait, so let me ask you about that. If you say you don't really see any other way out of the $100 million deficit that the legislature is facing, that the state is facing, is streamlining, but also you're saying quite possibly raising new revenue, which usually means raising new taxes in one way or another, it sounds like maybe you're saying it's an inevitability, but then also trying to say you don't support it.
I don't want it to be an inevitability, but I've seen the hole we've dug over the past 4 years, and I don't know how else it's going to make any progress of getting us out of that. But I am in not any way, shape, or form in favor of going in that direction.
So then what happens if the only way out is raising taxes, and you're saying you won't vote for them?
Well, just that. The other side is going to have to propose raising taxes, and I'm going to be voting against it.
Oh, I see. But because the Democrats might vote for it, it could still pass with your vote against.
They've done it before, and I've voted against before. In fact, I've for four straight years voted against the budget for the very reason that I'm now talking about. And I imagine that I'll be voting against it again. So I'm sure if they decide they want to pass new taxes, they're going to do it without my say-so.
Representative Sherman, where do you come down on this?
Well, I guess I would say first and foremost, for the past, we sort of have a new normal in the legislature, and that's unfortunate. And that normal is these budget deficits, exceedingly large budget deficits. Every year we come in, we have to deal with budget deficits. And that tells me that we are – that the governor and the legislative leadership and those who support these budgets are doing so without an eye on the future and exactly how we're going to pay for it. So when we come in with a budget of 4 or 5% increase and tax receipts of or an economy growing at 2%, you know, that's a real problem. And I think we need to, like Joe said, really concentrate on where we go from here and understand that this can't be a new normal and that we have to address it in a comprehensive and fundamental way. And that is bringing the state government into the 21st century, in my view. I think we are still stuck in a 19th and 20th century state government, and I think we need to move it into the 21st century with services being provided more efficiently and effectively, with more communication with the outside instead of this internal sort of functioning government that we have with people in the offices 5 days a week reading reports. Again, they work hard. Our state employees work hard, but I think we need to move the government into the 21st century. That said, I also think we need to focus first and foremost on our economy and the health of our state's economy, and we have neglected that for years, and that is why we're in the position we're in.
So, Representative Sherman, what would you suggest? I mean, I've heard now from both of you this idea of streamlining government, making services more efficient. So where do you see room for cuts and what would you like to see?
I guess I would say, I wouldn't propose specific cuts right now until we really get into it. It's very difficult as a citizen legislature to get into specific departments and micromanage those departments. I think it needs to come from the administration and the leadership at the administration to set an agenda for how exactly we're going to do this and streamline and have more effective and efficient services. I would say, for example, again, when you're talking about the economy and really trying to grow our economy so that it is a long-term sort of laser-like focus on the economy. I think, for example, the Agency of Commerce, people should be in their offices once a week, one day a week, and they should be out in the field 4 days a week and really just talking to people, seeing what businesses need, seeing what our small employers need and what their challenges are, what their opportunities are, and where we as a state might be able to help them. So that is just one example. And again, I'll go back to the economy. When you have we have personal income tax. The reason we're in the situation we're in is our personal income tax receipts are down, and that's due to payroll and that our economy is stagnant, and so we really need to focus on growing our economy, and I hope that will be the number one priority in the legislature.
We've got a few minutes here with a pair of Republicans looking at legislative priorities for 2015. So listeners, if you have a question for them, you should call now. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post a question at vpr.net. We're going to have some time with two of the progressives in the legislature coming up in just a minute. We asked listeners on Facebook what they'd like the legislative priorities to be this session. Catherine says if they accomplish nothing but reducing property taxes and spending, I think they should consider it a successful session. Jim says property tax reform, property tax reform, property tax reform. Ivan chimes in with revisit the universal health care with a more long-term plan to achieve it, like change the way income taxes are collected using aggregate gross income. Rick's thoughts, reducing taxes, legalizing marijuana, and getting real broadband internet for everyone, including pressing VTEL to do what they were given tax money to do. Representative Sherman, another top priority for you, obviously budget, a huge one, but where else do you want to go?
I will agree with the first two commenters on VPR. I've been in there 8 years, and for those 8 years, this will be my fifth term. One of my highest priorities has always been education and education funding reform. I've had a proposal out there for the last 6 years. I've been, you know, beating the drum for reform and a real transformation of our education system and the education funding system, and I'm hopeful that actually happens. I want to provide more and greater opportunities to our students. I want to reconnect taxpayers to the budgets voted upon and money spent, and I want to reconnect them to the outcomes achieved by our students. I think that's important in order to really understand what we're getting out of the money spent. So I think by doing that, you can reform and provide property tax relief. So That's what I'm hopeful for, and we'll be, again, using anything I can to ensure that that happens.
And Senator Benning, let me bring you back in here. Your thoughts there on property tax reform.
Jane, I think all of us who are candidates during the last election cycle heard very loudly and clearly from those folks who are mirroring those comments you just read. Property taxes are getting out of control. Our education system, the funding system, has to be overhauled. And it is my hope to be able to get on to the Education Committee and start to work to make that change happen. We actually have a pretty good educational system in this state. I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, but the funding mechanism long ago disconnected the average taxpayer from being able to have a say in how education tax dollars were raised and spent. And I don't know if we're ever going to get back to that situation where the local property tax owner or payer has the ability to have some say in that discussion. But we really do have to take a look at the way that we fund education and make it sustainable in such a way that we can afford it. We are not at that position right now, so I, as far as I'm concerned, I'm going to make that one of my top priorities heading back into the session.
Well, let's go to Patrick, who's calling in from St. Johnsbury. Patrick, you have some thoughts and questions about education reform.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm just calling in regards to education reform, primarily, especially in terms of funding. I know that as a teacher, I'm looking towards decreased revenues, but there are districts that are actually growing. And one of my biggest concerns is I'm in an area where we only send to private schools. And the private schools essentially say what we as taxpayers have to pay them and have no accountability to the taxpayer other than a formula. And at the end of the day, when they vote down their budget, they're voting down a very small percent that they can control. And I'm wondering what kind of reform might be on the table to fix those revenue problems, especially in school choice communities where they go to private schools.
Patrick, thanks for the call. My understanding of the kind of community you're talking about, there are certain communities still in Vermont where there are private schools with a private-public partnership, and so public school students do go to those academies as tuition students. So, Heidi Sherman, what do you think there about Patrick's thoughts?
No, thanks, Patrick, for the question. I guess I would say I would remove the state as much as possible from the education funding system. While we can still comply with Brigham, and I would support and advocate for complying with Brigham, obviously, to ensure equal educational opportunity for all of our students. But we can do it by bringing it back to the locals, and by local I mean regional, in this sense. And I think by doing that, whether you're a public school or a private school, you can open up school choice for that region. You'll be able to do it, and your budget, what you vote on, is what you pay for. As a region, for all of your school budgets in that region. It's hard to explain in 2 seconds or 2 minutes, but it is possible to do that. And again, you reconnect voters to the budgets voted upon and money spent. You provide greater opportunities for students, and you reconnect all of the taxpayers and Vermont adults with the outcomes of the students and where their money is, how well their money is being spent.
Well, in 2013, you sponsored legislation that would have changed that system, and it would have streamlined the supervisory union system so that basically we had 15 educational districts, and taxes were raised within those districts, so
that's
in
correct.
15 different places. And that would get rid of all of those supervisory unions, and those districts would also determine teacher salaries district-wide. Is that something that you're hoping to bring up again?
I've modified it. It's gonna be modified a bit with more specifics with regard to the districts themselves, and with I've got updated numbers to make sure that we have equity throughout the state. And yes, I plan to reintroduce it. And when Joe gets on the Education Committee in the Senate, I would love to present it to his committee and present it to him. So.
Joe Benning, I'd love to have you address, in the time we have left, your thoughts on the first order of business, or one of the first, that's going to come before you in the legislature, and that is choosing the governor. Who are you going to vote for?
I've made it very clear, Jane, that I intend to vote for Scott Milne. I've said repeatedly that you can look at this from a statewide plurality, which some people call a tradition, but our Constitution does not demand we go that way. You can look at this as representing your constituents, and in my case, my district overwhelmingly voted for Scott Milne, but again, our Constitution does not require us to go that way. I have looked at this all along as what does my conscience tell me moving forward is best for the state. And after the 4 years of history we have had digging ourselves into the hole we are in, my conclusion is that I don't want to continue in that same direction, and it's time to change horses.
You will, however, after you vote for Scott Milne, also hope to introduce a change, an amendment to the Constitution as far as these elections go. And you'd like to see a runoff with voters choosing, constituents choosing between the top two vote getters if no one gets a majority?
That is correct. I honestly believe that the time has come to change the Constitution's setup. The people should always have the final say in what goes on in our elected officials. But at this point, our Constitution does not enable that to happen. The Constitution is very clear that if you don't get 50% plus one of the top three office holders in this state, the election is essentially void ab initio, meaning it's not an election. So it throws it directly into the legislature, and I've felt very uncomfortable about that. I think people have the right to have a say in the conversation. So holding a runoff election, I think, is very important, and I'm going to try to do that.
That's Joe Benning. He's a senator from Lindenville representing Caledonia County, and he's Senate Minority Leader. Senator Benning, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Heidi Sherman, before we say goodbye to you, who are you going to be voting for?
Like Joe Benning, I'll be voting for Scott Milne. I think the lack of guidance provided in the Constitution to legislators on this vote is informative in and of itself, and I think we are supposed to vote for the person that we believe will be a better governor. So
that's Heidi Sherman. She represents Stowe in the Vermont House. She's a member of the Commerce and Economic Development Committee. Representative Sherman, thanks very much.
Thank you, Jane. Appreciate it.
Coming up, we're going to be speaking with two progressives about their top priorities in the upcoming legislative session that starts on Wednesday. You're listening to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're looking at legislative priorities for the session about to start in Montpelier. We just heard from two members of the Republican caucus, and we turn now to the progressives. Chris Pearson is the House Progressive Leader, and he represents Burlington. He is on the Health Care Committee and the Climate Action Caucus. Representative Pearson, nice to have you on the program.
Great to be here, Jane. Thanks.
And Senator David Zuckerman from Hinesburg represents Chittenden County. He's Vice Chair of the Agriculture Committee, and he serves on the Senate Education Committee. Nice to have you back on the program.
Thanks for having me.
So we were talking earlier with two members of the Republican caucus about their priorities, and let's start with the big one for you guys, and then we can branch into some of the others as well, and that is the budget. Certainly looking down the barrel of a $100 million shortfall is not easy, but seems to be a familiar experience for legislators at this point. So Representative Pearson, where do you see areas to streamline government? Do you think raising taxes is the way to go? How are we going to do this?
Well, I do think it's time to look at new revenue. Since I've been there in the legislature, I'm going into my fifth term. I'm pretty sure every year we've seen budget shortfalls. So this idea that we can continue to make cuts and people won't notice, these are just efficiencies. We call the challenges for change under Governor Douglas. I think is a fiction. I think we have to get real about it. And I do think it's important to look at revenue. The fact is the economy is not booming for most Vermonters. Median household income is about $53,000. That means half of all Vermont houses are earning $53,000 or less. So that goes a little beyond living paycheck to paycheck. And unfortunately, that reality is often not front and center in Montpelier. So one of the roles that the progressives try to play is to remind people of that. I think it's time to look at revenues. I think we could make changes. You were talking earlier about adjusted gross income and changes to the structure of the income tax. You could give tax break to about 60% of Vermonters and get a little more from people who have been booming. And I think that's the right idea. But I would say that one of the things I agree with Representative Sherman and Senator Benning about is we would be wise to do a deep dive in some part of the budget. And it's very difficult. We're there for about 4 months. We're a so-called volunteer legislature, citizen legislature. I would like, if I were in charge, I'd like to see us take one department a year and really dive in and see where we can we can make better connections. And, you know, oftentimes hear from the actual state workers doing on the front lines as opposed to just the department heads. I think
that's the job of the auditor, to take that deep dive in and see where there's possibility for streamlining things and how money's being spent. I mean, why not rely on that office?
Well, he has a very limited budget. He does do that, and he has been quite successful in pointing out places we can save money. And it's been an interesting relationship to watch Auditor Hoffer put forward proposals and the administration soak them up. But we can't just depend on him. He has a limited staff and a limited budget. So.
Before we get into David Zuckerman's thoughts here, let's go to Charles in Middlebury. Hi, Charles. Your thoughts here. Hi, Charles. You on? We can hear you.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. I have two comments. One, I think the way to deal with this budget overrun is they have to take the established budget, and whatever percentage that we're overspending, we cut every line item by that percentage right now with no exceptions. We can't spend money that we don't have. And yes, it's going to hurt, but we'll have to deal with it. I think the private sector deals with those types of things all the time. I know I do in my business. And also, we talked about stimulating the Vermont economy, and what's hurting the Vermont economy is taxation. I mean, if you want to stimulate the Vermont economy, we eventually have to cut taxes.
Charles, thanks for your call. Yeah, I hear you. Your phone line's a little bit squishy there, but Charles trying to say, look, why don't you just take sort of a percentage, cut it across the board. If you've got a budget and you have to live by that budget, you can't spend money that you don't have. Where do you come down on that, Senator Zuckerman?
Well, that's certainly a straightforward approach, but one that I think has consequences to it. Representative Shurman also spoke about streamlining or cutting different parts of government. And I would just remind folks that under the Douglas administration, there were a lot of cuts to the Department of Children and Families. And now 4, 5, 6 years later, we've seen those impacts, and we now have a triage situation with way over overloaded caseworkers and tragic results.
Although we should point out that those budget cuts to the Department for Children and Families and to the AHS budget in general were not just under the Douglas administration,
right?
Under the Shumlin administration.
Absolutely. So I was just pointing out where they started. But when you continue those kinds of cuts, there are consequences. So I think a broad brush approach like that has actually some very dangerous consequences. Are there areas where we could potentially get more efficient? Certainly. I've been looking, as someone on the education committee, wondering whether we could use some of the facilities to house some social services folks from Health and Human Services, because really one of the reasons education budgets are going up is because we're doing social services in the schools. Why not have the social service experts do that so the teachers could be teachers and maybe find some efficiencies there? So I think there's ways to have different agencies in government work more closely together to create efficiencies and save some money rather than just the broad brush.
Do you see efficiency and streamlining as a way to get out of a $100 million deficit, or are we going to have to raise taxes?
No, I don't think we can do it just through efficiencies in 1 year. As Representative Pearson mentioned, you know, it takes a really deep look at various departments to find those savings, and we certainly should be doing that more thoroughly with a couple of committees a year in their particular arenas. But to do it all at once in 1 year, I think it would be very, very difficult, and I do think we need to find some revenues.
Steve's calling in from South Burlington. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
Good.
My question is, why don't they just get it over with, legalize marijuana? I know the police, the state police and whatever, say it's an evil thing and everything, but how many police officers were arrested last year for alcohol, which is 10 times worse? I mean, you know, prescription drugs also, and so forth. So it would create a lot more revenue, and I think that we'd get out of the hole in a year or two.
Steve, thanks for the call. And speaking of what Steve was saying, Theo also wrote in on this topic. He says it's politically possible to legalize marijuana this year. The state's RAND study showed how to tax it, and everybody would like new revenue to work with. For the GOP, it's a win for being pro-business and smaller government. For progressives, it's a win for justice for citizens' rights and ending the racist drug war. Given that everybody can win here, what's required to pass a bill to tax hemp and medical marijuana? And going on what Steve was saying, to legalize marijuana. Representative Pearson?
Well, I think Steve should know that in Senator Zuckerman and myself, you have probably the two of the most pro-legalization legislators in Montpelier. And actually, Senator Benning, to his credit as well, is there with us. And so the question is, what is in the way? There is a mindset of let's wait and watch Colorado and Washington, and Colorado's now been there for a year. But there's interesting early data coming out of there that I want to understand more. But what people are telling me is that you're seeing a good impact on hard drug overdoses are down, suicides and other kinds of mental illness, you know, often drug dependence problems are actually improving. You haven't seen an uptick in young people using marijuana. So it is only a year, and I think we have to be realistic about that. But certainly I expect a bill will be introduced. I am likely to sponsor it myself. I imagine Senator Zuckerman, he can speak for himself, but we'll do the same in the Senate, and we'll be trying to push that forward. So Steve should be in touch with his own legislators, and you know, it's time. I mean, the idea that we treat marijuana differently than alcohol is just kind of absurd. It's time to regulate it, to tax it, to recognize that Vermonters sometimes choose to use marijuana. This has been going on for centuries, and it's time to have an adult conversation about it.
So maybe it will not get through in this year, but you think within this biennium, the 2-year biennium, you hope to have legalization passed?
Well, I would love that. But, you know, I think that's optimistic. I think we got to see where the conversation takes us.
Before we move on that, I want to give you a chance.
Sure. I mean, I've been working with Senator Benning and some other Senate colleagues to introduce a bill this year, certainly to get the conversation going. I know that Senator Sears' top priority is the DCF issues, and that'll take the first month. But I'm hoping to get that onto the agenda some ways a little bit farther into the session. I think there is tripartisan support. There's clearly revenue potential. There's clearly positive impacts with respect to the issues that Representative Pearson was talking about. You know, people today say don't do it because kids are going to smoke it. And the reality is it's easier to get marijuana in high school than it is alcohol. So why do we want to keep it that way? Don't we want to have it regulated and more difficult for young people to get? So I think those arguments need to keep being made. Constituents need to call their legislators, and I think we can potentially move it.
Progressives were, if not pushing hard, certainly by and large supporting the universal health care plan that the governor was looking for. Now that that's off the table, at least for the governor, at least for now, where do you two plan to go with health care payment reform and health care issues? Senator Zuckerman is pointing at Chris Pearson because Representative Pearson, this is something you've been pretty vocal about.
Well, I've served on the Health Care Committee for the last 4 years, and it's been an exciting and challenging time to do that. At some level, I've been a big supporter of single payer since I first ran for office in 2006 and frankly before that. At some level, I don't disagree with the conclusion the governor reached, but I'm disappointed in the way he went about it, and many of the details frustrate me. The bottom line is the way we pay for healthcare today is so confusing and so convoluted that just flipping a switch to a fair system, it represents enormous dislocation. And so I think that a better approach, and what I wish the governor had pivoted and said, is let's look at some of the goals of Act 48, covering everybody. That should be doable. We should be able to do that within the next year or so. And that's a huge goal. And when you have bring every Vermonter into the health system, you start to be able to treat it like the system that it sort of is. We already have, you know, if you are uninsured and you break your leg crossing the road, you go to the hospital and you get care. It's just that the way we pay for that is absurd, and we don't really treat that like a form of insurance, which it is. So I think we can cover everybody. I think we can continue some of the progress we've made with the Blueprint for Health and some of the delivery reforms and also some of the cost shift, some of the payment methodologies. The other thing that's crazy about the way we do it today is every patient that walks into Fletcher Allen, or what do we call
University
it now?
The University of Vermont Healthcare.
Gets a bill that is sent to Blue Cross. Every single person generates a single bill. That's a lot of bills. I mean, it's not a piece of paper. We're beyond the days when it goes in an envelope and is mailed to Berlin, where Blue Cross handles their payments. But we ought to look at that as a community, you know, and Blue Cross and the hospital ought to be able to sit down and say, well, you know, you give us $12 million every month. You know, why don't we figure out a way that can just do that, that streamlines it a little bit, cut down on some administrative costs. We don't need single payer to make those kinds of advances. And I think there's a lot of opportunity to go forward.
And you will be trying to still look at healthcare in this biennium?
Oh, absolutely. And you're hearing that from the speaker on down, that this is not over. In fact, the discussion over the last 4 years has brought pretty broad agreement that what we're doing today isn't good, and we need to make advances.
Senator Zuckerman, what about for you, another top priority for you in the Senate?
Well, I was going to add one last bit on the healthcare issue, which is I was also recently meeting with independent doctors who actually get a significantly lower rate of reimbursement from Blue Cross and Blue Shield, and often actually meet with more patients in a day than doctors at some of the larger institutions. And so we should also look at that sort of scenario and say, if we can make the pay for independent doctors a little bit more fair, and more people go that route and they are seeing people more effectively and more efficiently, then potentially we can also actually save money throughout the system with that arena. So that's certainly something. I mentioned with respect to government services and health and human services, moving some of that into education and into our schools. And if we did that, we could also look potentially at reducing some overlapping costs there. So whether it's education taxes that might be able to be reduced as opposed to cutting as much state government, then that's something I'd like to really look at as a member of the Education Committee if I remain on that committee.
Yeah, that's right. Committee assignments change sometimes in the new biennium, so we'll see where you go.
Well, and one other issue is weatherization. Weatherization of our homes is both an environmental issue and an economic issue. It's jobs for people who are in the construction business, and it's energy efficiency. It's just a no-brainer. We've got to find money for that.
And both of you voting for Peter Shumlin for governor?
Well, that's a secret ballot, Jane, but...
if you're coming clean on that, if you're going to be public about it.
I will be. I've heard from a lot of constituents advocating for Scott Milne, but and saying the state really wants that. But I know people who chose not to vote in the governor's race, but they'd still prefer Shumlin. They just thought he was going to win by 10%. And also, if there was a big push for change, turnout would have been up, not down.
Chris Pearson.
I expect the governor will have my vote.
All right. That's Representative Chris Pearson, House Progressive Leader representing Burlington, and Senator David Zuckerman from Hinesburg representing Chittenden County. Thank you both very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
I want to remind listeners we'll be at the State House in Montpelier for the opening of the session on Wednesday, and you can tune in to VPR and VPR.net all week and all session for more legislative coverage. Coming up in our series for young readers, we'll get to know an albino Tanzanian boy named Habo. Dorothy's List is next on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. It's time now for Dorothy's List, our monthly book club for kids based on books nominated for the Dorothy Canfield Fisher Children's Book Award. This month, we go to the West Rutland School, where sixth graders have been reading a difficult book, Golden Boy by Tara Sullivan. Golden Boy tells the story of an albino Tanzanian boy named Habo. Habo is forced to flee across his country when a poacher tries to hunt him down. VPR's Amy Noyes spent time with the students and the author for our series, Dorothy's List.
Golden Boy is a book that's hard to categorize. It reads like historical fiction, but the real-life circumstances are both modern-day and horrifying. The novel takes on the subject of ivory poaching, and even more shocking for these sixth graders in West Rutland, a human parallel— the murder of albino people whose body parts are thought to bring good luck.
So wait, there were people that actually killed innocent kids or adults that were albino?
Yes.
Because they thought their limbs were lucky.
It's a tough concept for some young readers to grasp. But West Rutland School librarian Dawn Sharon thinks these students are ready to take on advanced themes.
I think what I've noticed with a lot of you is that all of a sudden you guys are old enough to start thinking about topics that affect your world. And this is the first book that a lot of you have got to read that really have some very important issues that are happening, not necessarily in your town, but definitely in your world that affect people and animals and things that you might care about.
The students were ready to engage with the book, and we recorded the questions they had for author Tara Sullivan. Sixth grader Caitlin Shug wanted to know if Sullivan set out to write a book with that level of intensity.
To me, in this book, it felt very intense, and I was wondering if you meant it to feel that way or you worried about it being, so scary.
Yeah, it is scary. That's Golden Boy author Tara Sullivan.
I think it is a scary reality, and I did want to share that honestly to the best of my ability. When I went to Tanzania, one of the things that was most meaningful is that I was able to meet up with the staff of Under the Same Sun, which is one of the organizations working in the field. They mainly do informational advocacy, you know, sharing about, hey, albinism is a genetic condition. It takes both the mother and the father to contribute to albinism. It is not a curse. They are not ghosts. They're not demons. They don't melt in the sun. If you put your baby out in the sun with albinism, they won't tan. They will just get sick.
Sullivan says Under the Same Sun helped with their understanding of Tanzanian people who are albino.
When I met with them, I really got a sense of, the tragedy that it is to live that way, to be told horrible things about why you are the way you are and why you look the way you do, and to be told, hey, you're not a real person. Hey, you're nothing. You're actually a zero-zero. You're less than nothing. You're nothing-nothing. And how that affects people. And I wanted to be able to tell that story as honestly as I could while showing that, you know, everyone can be something. So I would say hold out there. I know it's a tough read at the beginning, maybe, because it's a very difficult subject. But I promise, I'm a sucker for happy endings. Things get better. I will not leave Habo in the lurch in a way that makes you feel upset. I hope that by the time you hit the end of the book, you'll be feeling a bit better.
In Golden Boy, Habo and his family are forced to leave their village home to start a new life in the city. Here's author Tara Sullivan reading a passage from Habo's point of view at the beginning of their journey.
I've never been to Arusha before. The farthest I've been from home is our village school and the places I wander when I'm grazing the goats. I know where I'm supposed to stay, in our house, in the shadows of the wall, in the shade of the trees, out of the sun, and out of sight. The scorched path of gray dust leading from our little village into Arusha is not my place. I learned this the day I tried to follow Asu as she left for secondary school in the city. I made it as far as the front yard when Mother grabbed me by the arm and hauled me inside. "Don't even think about it, Habo," she had said. "Don't you dare think about shaming us in the city, too." I had stared up at her then, unable to say anything, terrified by the intensity in her voice. Mother and I have always been like the two posts of a doorframe, unable to move closer or farther away, and the emptiness that sits between us is the shape of my missing father. He left right after I was born, when the whispers started that Razia gave birth to a white son, not a good brown child like the three born before him, but white.
Sixth grader Ella Paquin asked about Habo's relationship with his older sister, Asu.
How did you decide that Asu would be the one to care for and love Habo?
When I was doing my research, and finding out more about the families of children with albinism, it was hard. It was very heartbreaking. A lot of fathers leave their families because they can't imagine that they could produce a white child. So they assume their, you know, wife was cheating on them. And so there's a lot of abandonment. And so I was getting this sense through my research of a very harsh environment, a very hostile world where sometimes not even your parents would be in your corner if you were born with albinism. And yet finding that there were always, you know, hopefully always, but frequently mothers or sisters or older siblings who would really go to bat for kids with albinism, who would really try to take care of them and step up to the plate. And Asu was easy for me to write because I have a much younger brother. He's 10 years younger than me. And so it was a character that I could connect with and put myself into and go from there. So that's kind of why I decided that Asu would be the one to love Habo.
Sixth grader Elizabeth Bailey asked about the violence portrayed in the book during Habo's journey across Tanzania.
How do you think the violence contributed to the plot of the story?
I think that's a great question, Elizabeth. And I think one of the things that I struggled with while I was writing this was how to portray the violence, because I don't like books that are just violence, violence, violence all over the place with no real purpose to it. But at the same time, I was trying to tell a story about a really horrific thing where people are attacking other people and hacking them to pieces and maiming them and injuring them and murdering them. And to try and find a way to tell that story with the right amount of violence was something that I definitely struggled with, something that I thought about a lot. And so what you might notice is that the violence that I describe is rarely aimed at characters. So there's a scene with an elephant where Habbo and his brother come across a poacher who is poaching ivory. And I included the graphic violence in that scene as a way to sort of just put the idea of the violence, the kind of violence I was talking about, into readers' heads. But that kind of violence is never delivered onto people in the book.
West Rutland sixth grader Mason Galante was curious about the names Tara Sullivan chose for her characters.
What language are the names in?
That is such a good question. So the names are in Swahili, and they actually mean things in Swahili. So Habbo is short for Dahahabo, which is the Swahili word for gold, which is where he gets his nickname Golden Boy from his sister Asu. Asubuhi is short for morning. Kito, his little cousin, means jewel in Swahili. And Kweli, one of my favorite characters from the second half of the book, his name means truth.
Sixth grader Madison Gway has a question about the research the author conducted when writing Golden Boy.
What did you find most surprising about the information when you, like, took information about this book?
I wrote the first draft of the book completely based off of research that I could do from my own home, right? And then once I had a first draft of the book written, I took kind of a leap of faith. I booked a ticket to Tanzania, and I traveled the path of the book. So I wanted to make sure that the story that I was putting out there was as accurate as I could possibly make it, was as true to life and honest as I could possibly make it. And so that little map that you see at the beginning of the book where it traces Habbo's journey, I actually followed Habbo's journey, went to every setting in Tanzania, and added in things that you could only find out when you're there, like, you know, the color of the dust and the types of trees that they had in a particular region and the taste of the food and all the rest of that. And I think some of the most surprising stuff was just finding out how much the internet got wrong and figuring out how to deal with it. So the book originally ended in Dodoma, which Google helpfully told me was the capital of Tanzania. Well, it turns out Dodoma was just the hometown of someone with a lot of power. And so they plopped parliament in this teeny tiny town. And there's nothing in Dodoma other than the parliament building and, like, one spare donkey. Like, there's really no city in Dodoma to end a story in. And so at the last minute, here I am in Tanzania. I'm like, oh my goodness, I need to get somewhere where I can end this story. I ended up booking a last minute ticket to Dar es Salaam, which is a huge international city and the capital in all but name. And it was there, as I was puddling around, you know, I found a carver's market that ends up being a major part of the ending of the book that I didn't know existed until I started walking around Dar es Salaam. So, yeah, the research was definitely a layered thing, a multifaceted thing that I did one thing at a time. And there were some really big surprises.
Once Habbo makes it to Dar es Salaam, he meets a blind artist who makes wood carvings to sell at a market. With that part of the story in mind, the West Rutland students' serious discussion took on a lighter note as they tried their hand at sculpting animals from dough while blindfolded. Haley Parker made a turtle with no small amount of feedback from her sighted friends.
Haley, it's just a circle.
Haley, I have to tell you something really bad. I don't think turtles are circles.
I hate to burst your bubble. It's Humpty Dumpty.
Oh, it's sweet. It looks like a turtle. Oh, his head fell off.
Is it a cookie with legs?
Having fun while learning to read difficult material is a hard feat to pull off. Golden Boy introduced some grave cruelties to these West Rutland sixth graders, but both the book and their serious discussion ended on happier notes. For VPR News, I'm Amy Noyes.
And the book again is Golden Boy by Tara Sullivan. Next month on Dorothy's List, our book is P.S. B11 by Rita Williams Garcia, a professor at the Vermont College of Fine Arts. The novel examines questions of race in 1970s New York City. Here's an excerpt read by West Rutland School sixth grader Elizabeth Bailey.
Big Ma was still talking about the nice white man who didn't have me arrested, whipped, or strung up. She assured me that all of the above would have happened if we were down home in Autauga County, Alabama. For the life of her, she couldn't understand why I didn't humbly and full out apologize. Didn't I value any of my 11 years and 10 months? She said, "It's that no mothering mother we got to thank for all of this." After paying tribute to Cecile, she swore I had stepped down on the known and unknown graves of every Charles, Gaither, and Trotter who had to bow and scrape before the white man to keep from getting strung up in an oak tree or drowned in the Alabama River.
That's an excerpt from PSB11. It's the next book in our monthly series about the books nominated for the Dorothy Canfield Fisher Children's Book Award. Dorothy's List is sponsored by the VPR Journalism Fund. And that's it for today. Tomorrow, with so much talk about the importance of early childhood education, we'll delve into the science of brain development in infants and toddlers. We'll hear from a researcher and a pediatrician on what influences the brain from before birth through young adulthood. So send your questions or comments about early childhood brain development to vermontedition@vpr.net, and be sure to tune in tomorrow at noon for the live broadcast. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing. Mary Williams directed the program. Amanda Shepard was our call screener. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen, and our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.